When I think back over the years of the fall meetings, and Neil Pryor, back when he could remember names, used to preach this meeting. But he's having a bit of difficulty now, and so they've called on me to fill in. And when I think about Neil and the way he always gave us such good direction, and he always made the students feel so much at home. Now, he even made us feel at home, the people who lived here. It was just really excellent the way he would speak, and the simplicity and the solidness of the direction. And I just thought about him, and I began to think, what can I say this week that would really give us a sense of true direction and that would point us to things that are lasting and real, that would help us to be genuine, that would nudge us a bit closer to eternity and to the God who controls it. And I was confident that we would get pretty close to something that was real by reminding you that you're going to be what you believe. And if you don't know what you believe, you don't really know who you are. And many of you, in fact, all of you who have come as students, have come out of homes, most of you at least, have come out of homes that where you operated pretty well on your mother and father's faith, and you failed to measure up to the expectations that were in that community, just like all of us did who were people. But you've come into a community where, if you're not careful, you're going to be tempted to live by somebody else's faith here. And you're going to be called upon to live up to some expectations that, unless there's something that's changed in you, you're going to be living by external motivations rather than what's internal. And so if I could help us to kind of maybe take off some masks, I think I'd be a help to you this week. If I could just get you to take off some masks, be real. And I want to ask you a question that we've already alluded to. Do you ever struggle with your faith? Do you struggle with your faith? Do you ever wonder sometimes whether you believe or not? Do you ever wonder what you believe? Do you ever wonder how much you believe? Do you ever cry out, "Oh God, I do believe, but help me overcome my unbelief"? Are you ever just simply shocked at the disparity between what you say and what you do? I am. Are you ever disturbed when somebody asks you to express your faith? Are you ever terribly uncomfortable when it comes to sharing your faith with your roommate or with even your mothers and fathers or with someone, stranger or friend? Do you find yourself struggling like a man trying to keep an octopus all bolted down, all eight limbs of him? About the time you think you've got it under control, here one slips out, and you keep going all through life trying to nail down your faith to where you can really stand on it and say, "This I believe, and I'm ready to go to the gallows for it." Well, let me just say this, that welcome to the Klan. Welcome to the party. We're all like that. And you know what? You're here. You're sitting right here this morning as students. And if you'll allow me to talk to the students first, as I always seem to end up doing, you old cows can get it the best way you can. Here you sit this morning, and you know what you think? You think you're the only one sitting here that's like you. And you think you are a nerd, some of you do. Think you're a nerd, that think you're the out of the ordinary one, and you think, "Well, there's nobody else here that feels like I do." And you're wrong. Everybody here feels like you do. To one degree or other, we're all in the same boat. We all feel the same way. We're all about the same cut. There's not anybody really any better than anybody else, and there's not anybody really any worse than anybody else. We're all undone. And just let that make you kind of relax and see if we can't be urged to just explore a bit and maybe take off our masks and be real. I wonder why it is that you have such struggle in your faith. Well, for one reason is because of the fact that the struggle, or that the process of faith, was intended to be a struggle. It never was intended to be anything else. The process of faith has always been a struggle. It's inevitable. It's essential. It's even legitimate. It's okay. You don't have to feel ashamed if you're struggling with your faith. You don't have to wear masks and play like you don't struggle with your faith. And if there's anybody here today that says he doesn't struggle with his faith, he would probably lie about other things too. So be careful about anybody that would tell you, I don't struggle with my faith, I know. He's a liar. That's just plain and simple. He's not telling the truth. We all struggle with our faith. The main thing I want to encourage you this week is to be honest. Just be honest. Be willing to say, well, I don't know, if you don't know. Be willing to say, well, I'm looking into that one. But the main thing is just simply be honest. It's a struggle that all people who have come to faith must go through, and you're not going to be any exception. The exception may be that if you are willing to say, I want to be honest, and I'm struggling through it, that may be the exception. Though Paul said we all walk by faith and not by sight, he said we walk by faith and not by sight, but it's true that all of us would rather walk by sight and skip the faith. We don't like walking by faith. It makes us terribly uneasy. We feel at loose ends. We would really rather walk by something that's nailed down, that's spelled out, that's listed in 10 basic rules where we can check them off, and having checked them off, we can go home feeling like we have arrived. But more often than not, though we don't like to walk by faith, we would rather walk by sight. Often we end up walking behind a mask. Playing like we believe, playing like we're all right, playing like we're together, and we end up being dishonest, really, and untrue to ourselves. But a second reason that we struggle so with faith is that we're confined to living within the framework and working within the limitations of secondary evidence. I mean by that, there are no eyewitnesses to the deity of Jesus Christ. You know what I mean by primary and secondary evidence? Primary evidence is what you've seen with your own eyes. Secondary evidence is what you have heard other people say they saw with their own eyes, or that they experienced in their own life. And if you didn't experience that or have not experienced that, and they tell you, well, this is what I saw, that's secondary evidence that's coming to you, and it has a tendency to push you to doubt, not faith. Especially if the things that are attested to lie outside the realm of your experience or anybody else's experience that you know. It has a tendency, this secondary evidence, has a tendency to kind of push you aside and say, well, I don't know about that. But you see, that's the only kind of evidence that we've got about the deity of Jesus. But it's legitimate. Turn in your Bibles to John, the 20th chapter, and let me show you the process. And let me show you where we are, and let me show you how to resolve it and arrive at a position where you can come to a pretty reasonable conclusion about what you believe. Look at John 20, verse 19. On the evening of that day, the first day of the week, that day what? What was so special about it? You say it was the day of the resurrection. Would you settle for the day of the alleged resurrection? Would that make you uncomfortable? That's the way they felt about it. They didn't believe the resurrection when this event was happening. They didn't believe it. They thought it was just just gossip. On the evening of that day, the day of the alleged resurrection, the first day of the week, the doors being shut where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. Now that's, they were receiving primary evidence there. They were standing in his presence, seeing it with their own eyes. But Thomas wasn't there. Thomas was somewhere else, who knows where. And when they came to Thomas and said, "Thomas, we've seen the Lord," Thomas didn't say, "Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. I've been waiting all day for that report." Thomas said, "Unless I see in his hands the print of the nails and place my finger in the mark of the nails and place my hand in his side, I will not believe." That's pretty honest. That's pretty bold. But you know what? That's what really is required if you're ever going to come to real faith. We're going to have to be willing to bite the bullet and admit honest doubt. Otherwise, you end up spending your life glossing over your questions, glossing over your doubts, glossing over your uncertainties. The time has got to come in the life of every person who recognizes the value of life He's got to come to the place where he's willing to say, unless something happens, I will not believe it. I cannot believe it. Well, that's where Thomas came to. 8 days passed by. The next Sunday night, this was on Sunday night that happened, you know. You miss some good things on Sunday night if you don't come. Thomas missed that. Well, the next Sunday night, he learned his lesson. It just took him 1 week. He learned his lesson, came back the next Sunday night, and Jesus blessed that assembly again and came among them, and he said, peace be with you. And then he said to Thomas, come here. Place your hand in my side. And it's so strange. He said, bring your hand here and place it in my side. And bring your fingers here and place them in my nail prints. And then he said, don't be faithless, Thomas. You believe. But what happened? Jesus upgraded his evidence to primary evidence. And Thomas said, my Lord and my God. And he responded accordingly. But you know what? We don't have any primary evidence today. You and I don't. There are no eyewitnesses to the deity of Jesus Christ among us. Nobody here is an eyewitness. Nobody here has primary evidence. All we've got is secondary evidence. And even one of those four is tertiary. Luke wrote not from what he saw. He wrote a historical account based upon what other people said they saw. So we've got three gospels that are secondary evidence, one that's tertiary evidence. And you said just a moment ago that secondary or tertiary evidence has the tendency to push a person to doubt. That's right. Well, then how can I, if all we've got is secondary evidence, how can I come to faith by using secondary evidence if it has a tendency to push us to doubt? Well, don't worry about it. You do it every day. You know, you and I have come to accept the fact that this whole atmosphere is filled with radio waves. We know that. We've listened to radio for so many years that we never even think about anybody questioning that it's filled with radio waves. But your great-granddaddy would have. If somebody had said to him, Uncle Josh, this whole place is filled full of radio waves, he would have said, get off my back, man. He would have said a little bit different. He would have said, dislocate yourself off my posterior, fella. But he would have meant the same thing. Get off my back. Who do you think I am? I don't believe that. But then the fellow would have gone over and said, well, listen to this. And he would have turned on a little box, and there would have been voices coming out of that box, and your great-grandfather would have had to weigh and come up with a conclusion based upon something that he couldn't see, had a hard time believing, and something he couldn't deny. There it came out of that box. Same thing is true with television signals. Your grandfather, if you had told him, we're going to see people on that tube there, on that box, and that there are waves all through here, signals, television signals, all through the atmosphere, he would have said the same thing. Get off my back. Who do you think I am? I don't believe that. But then you just go over and turn on the TV set, and here comes Johnny Carson or whoever it is that's on there, and you say, there it is. And so he again is thrust into that dilemma of trying to decide if he will believe in something that's invisible based upon what he has seen that is visible. I was reading just a moment ago and thought, and let me just throw it in. In Romans, the first chapter, this is the big one. Listen here. He says here that in the beginning, ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made, so they're without excuse. See, the same struggle goes on with the big one. How can you believe in an invisible God? How can you believe in something that you can't see or feel or taste or touch? How can you? And yet, when you look around at all this evidence, and I saw the other night the full moon sitting there above the Arkansas skyline. It was gorgeous. A great big full moon sitting there smiling on me, and I thought, good grief. How on earth can I deny it? And I have struggles. I have struggles with the invisible God. And it seems like I get it all in place, and then something happens, and I keep going through this round and around and around, and yet I'm stared in the face by evidence, whether it's a little baby's tiny little hand with a half moon in his fingernail, or whether it's a beautiful sunset or a beautiful sunrise or good food or the ability to taste or to smell or the ability for one gray mass to communicate. Look at your gray masses, all of them, aren't they just going like that? Because another gray mass is communicating with you, and I'm looking at you through two eyeballs. Look at you. And we recognize, see there? It's there, and you are recognizing intelligence or lack of it. But at least you've got enough sense to recognize the lack of it. Where'd you get it? Well, yeah. So you do it every day. I wish I had time to tell about Heinrich Schliemann. But I'm just saying that this is the way we verify any kind of evidence and we come to grips with, and faith is always born like this. Up in Wisconsin the other day, I was speaking on this same subject to a bunch of teenagers. And after explaining the process to them, I said, give me some examples of this happening in your own life, where you hear something that is absolutely unbelievable. And you say, I just can't believe that. And yet you're confronted with something that is just virtually undeniable. And you're put in that tension between those two, and you finally have to make a decision, and you have to bite the bullet and believe it. Well, there was some silence, and I said, come on, give me an example of that happening in your own life. This young fellow raised his hand. I said, yeah, okay. He said, well, it had to do with my sister the other day. I told her when she said, I've got a date tonight. I said, you couldn't get a date if your life depended on it. He said, I don't believe it. She said, I have a date. I've got a date tonight. Well, he said, I don't believe that. But he said, you know what? About 3 o'clock that afternoon, the doorbell rang, and the florist delivered a corsage. And I looked at that corsage, he said, and I thought, And then about 6 o'clock, she began to go in there and get all gussied up. He didn't use that expression, but she got all fixed up, you know, and she was getting ready for something. And I kept thinking, she can't have a date, not her. But he said about 7:30, the doorbell rang, and there stood this big old hunk of a boy. And he said, I've come to pick up your sister. And he said, you know, I had to say, well, I'll be dogged. He had to draw a conclusion. He came to believe that she was telling him the truth. It's always been like that. Heinrich Schliemann, I don't have time to tell about him. Make me tell about him this week, though. I'll tell you about Heinrich this week if I have some more time. But turn to Mark, the second chapter. I want to show you this is the process that Jesus used to bring people to faith in his own identity. This is the way he went about it. Now, I want you to understand the process. It's in the tension between the things that are terribly difficult to believe and the things that are impossible to deny. It's in that tension between those two polarities that your faith is born. Now, the reason why I'm telling you all of this is so that you'll recognize why it is that you're always struggling with your faith. And I want you to see where it is that the struggle takes place. It takes place in between what you have a terribly difficult time believing and what you know full well you can't deny. It's in that tension that faith is born. And let me tell you, faith will not be born without that tension. It won't come without that tension. And it's God-induced. So if you're struggling and you're wrestling and you're groping and you're grasping and you feel terribly uneasy and you go back and forth and you say, I believe. And then you say, well, I don't know whether I believe or not. And then how can I believe? And then, yeah, all that's God-induced. Listen. And when he returned to Capernaum after some days, it was reported that he was at home. And many were gathered together so that there was no longer room for them, not even about the door. And he was preaching the word to them. And they came bringing to him a paraplegic, carried by four men. And when they could not get near him because of the crowd, they removed the roof above him, and when they had made an opening, they let down the pallet on which the paraplegic lay. And when Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paraplegic, my son, your sins are forgiven. Now some of the scribes were sitting there questioning in their hearts, why does this man speak thus? It's blasphemy. Who can forgive sins but God alone? And immediately Jesus, perceiving in his spirit that they thus questioned within themselves, said to them, why do you question like this in your hearts? Which is easier, to say to the paraplegic, your sins are forgiven, or to say, rise, take up your pallet and walk? But that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he said to the paraplegic, I say to you, rise, take up your pallet and go home. And he rose and immediately took up the pallet on which he lay and went out before them all, so that they were all amazed and glorified God, saying, "We never saw anything like this before." You see the dynamic? You see the dynamic of the things that were difficult to believe and the thing that was impossible to deny? What was the thing that was terribly difficult for them to believe? The Pharisees, they sat there. What was the unbelievable thing in this story? That he could forgive sins. They said, "He can't do that." What if he had said, "I can too"? They would have said, "You can't either. Can too. Cannot. Can." How long would they have argued about it? Forever. They'd still be arguing about it today. What is this, the 28th? Still been arguing about it. But he knew that argument doesn't settle claims. And so he said, "Okay, I'll just do something that you can't deny." And he said, "Which is easier, to say your sins are forgiven, which you find it terribly difficult to believe, or to say, take up your pallet and go home, which, boys, you're not going to be able to deny," is what he was implying. But he said, "So that you'll know I can do this that you have difficulty believing, I'm going to do this that you can't deny." And he said, "Take up your pallet and go home." And the record says the man got up and walked out in front of all of them. And then, in a sense, Jesus just kind of leaned over and said to them, "Now fidget. Fidget." He's the chief fidgeteer. Jesus will always induce fidgeting. Always put people in this pressure. Always put them in the tension between what they could hardly believe and what they could hardly deny. And so that's where we are today. This was his method. This is what he did. This is the way he brought about faith. This is what I'm proposing for this week. Would you like to be a part of it? I'm not going to come before you assuming that you believe, except just a very little bit, because that's about all of us, any of us, believe, just a little bit. But I'm not going to come assuming that you do. I'm not going to put a lot of heavy pressure on you. I'm not going to assume that you know enough this morning to respond to an invitation. You may, and those of you who want to do that can. But I'm asking, really, that you give everybody the space to be honest this week. And I'm going to ask simply that you commit yourselves, make a decision this morning, every one of us. I'm asking you to make a decision. But it's not a heavy decision. It's not a big one. It only involves an hour of your life. I'm asking you to make a decision right now that you'll be back tonight. And let's discuss the undeniable Jesus tonight at 4 o'clock or 6 o'clock. I've asked the men who lead the singing to not lead any singing that would imply too much about the deity of Jesus Christ. At first, I said, lead songs that tell about where we are. And boy, the fellow this morning did that in the desert of sorrow and sin, and love for all, and can it be? These other songs that told about who we are. Does Jesus care when I've tried and failed? I said, lead that kind of song. And then let's sing as an invitation song, what will you do with Jesus? I would love to change it to what will I do with Jesus, but it gets all involved. Let's just sing it, what will you do with Jesus, but apply it to yourself. And we're going to sing that song as the invitation this morning, but the decision that really you're being called upon is, will you give 1 hour tonight, that's all, to explore, to see if perhaps we can come to a more solid foundation and come to the conclusion, I either do or I do not believe this whole thing. And then tonight I'm going to ask you to make the same decision. Would you come back Monday night? And Monday night we'll ask the same thing. Will you come back Tuesday night? Just an hour at a time, just one step at a time. That's all we're going to ask. And by the end of the meeting, by say Tuesday night or Wednesday night, it may be that you can answer the question, what will I do with him? And you'll get caught in the tension in the process between what you have a difficult time believing and what you have an impossible time denying. And you know what's going to happen? While we're together these 3 or 4 days, the process of faith that Jesus used to bring people to believe in him will be working in your own life. And you're going to be experiencing the same thing they were experiencing when he confronted them 2,000 years ago. That's exciting. Will you stand and let's sing this song together?